welcome to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. It was another exciting week on Capitol Hill as the rocking and rolling first 100 days of the Donald Trump administration approached its midpoint. And while there are plenty of question marks hanging over the 45th president, cybersecurity represents one of the few areas where the administration and its vision are being greeted with cautious optimism. But is that warranted? And what does the Trump administration's stated preference for a more cyber offense mean for the balance of power in the information realm? To talk about these issues and others, Security Ledger invited Dmitry Alperovich, the co-founder and chief technology officer of the firm CrowdStrike, into our studios to talk. Dmitry is one of the most respected authorities on so-called advanced persistent threats and nation-backed hacking. His firm was deeply involved in sorting out the attacks on the presidential campaign of Donald Trump's adversary, Hillary Clinton, and the Democratic National Committee. I started out by asking Dmitry about some of the newest trends and patterns his company is seeing in how sophisticated attacks and hacks are carried out.
Yeah, the general trend really is to blend in and become sort of the insider or look like an insider, where you're using things that would not otherwise generate suspicion. So obviously these malware-free types of techniques, whereas just PowerShell or WMI, are great at that. But even when you look across the kill chain and look at what the adversaries are doing after they get in, for example, for exfiltration, one of the techniques that we see the Russians use, the Russian adversaries that we saw at the DNC use, is Microsoft OneDrive account. And most listeners perhaps wouldn't know that you can actually mount a Microsoft OneDrive share via net use command, just on the command line in Windows. And this is exactly what these adversaries are doing. They're running NetUse, mounting the OneDrive account via an SSL connection. So at the network layer, everything would be encrypted. And all you would see are just connections to Microsoft, of course, would not trigger any suspicions. And then they just copy files over to that mounted network share. Very ingenious way of exfiltrating data without triggering any detections at the network layer. And you really just have to be at the endpoint to even see what's going on.
And leveraging the good reputation of Microsoft to kind of slip past the filter.
That's right. I mean, there are a lot of organizations now that use Microsoft Cloud, Microsoft services, and, you know, this would not trigger suspicions, particularly inside those organizations, that you have network connections going to Microsoft OneDrive.
So you spend a lot of your time in the Washington, D.C. area. You have conversations with folks on the policy side frequently. You know, with the new administration, there's a new focus on cyber offense and potentially acquiring cyber offensive tools from the private sector. Where do you see the state of play between the major cyber powers right now going in the next few years? More offense or the opposite?
Well, I think when you look at the state of the current players, certainly you have the big nation states that are sort of the major actors in cyberspace, be it Russia, China, Iran, North Korea are the main adversaries that the United States faces. But obviously, the United States has cyber command and tremendous capabilities, probably capabilities that are better than anyone else out there. Now, traditionally, under previous administrations, the U.S. government has been very hesitant to leverage those offensive capabilities. And there have been many stories in the papers over the years where during one conflict or another, like Libya, for example, and Iraq before then, that there were considerations about maybe we should use cyber offensive tools alongside kinetic weapons. And almost always they pulled back and decided not to do it. So ISIS is really the first time, the fight against ISIS, when they announced that they're actually leveraging cyber warfare capabilities in that fight. But the reality is that the U.S. government hasn't been very aggressive at using those tools offensively outside of its traditional espionage mission, which is performed by primarily the National Security Agency. So I think that the conversation really that I'm hearing right now, and certainly in the context of the Russian interference in our elections, is how do we use all tools that are in our toolbox from a national power perspective, be it diplomatic, economic, military, certainly, and cyber, to really create a deterrent effect against our adversaries. And that is really the conversation that's taking place literally today and this week as there are hearings on the Hill and discussions here in Washington about what to do vis-a-vis Russia. And it doesn't necessarily mean a cyber response, right? It means how do we create an environment where this type of behavior is considered to be outside of the norms that are that the nation states are allowed to perform inside of.
That sounds like a very sober conversation. That sounds like very much in keeping with kind of the tradition of U.S. diplomatic and security efforts and the way that the U.S. projects power, which is, you know, multilateral and using a variety of tools to, you know, as you said, create an environment in which people don't want to do bad things. I wouldn't characterize that as a brash sounding plan. That sounds pretty conventional.
It is. It is. And I think it's also, it reflects the fact that we're sort of growing up in terms of our understanding of this domain and realizing that cyber is a means to an end, right? That this is, at the end of the day, not about what cyber action took place, but what was the effect of that cyber action, right? The important thing about the 2016 elections were not the Russian hacks, but the impact of those Russian hacks and the foreign interference in our election that was done in part through the hacks and in part through, you know, the allegations of media propaganda and fake news and all the rest of it. But that's the important thing that people are starting to focus on, not the fact that there were hacks into various campaigns and different political organizations. And the response to that may not necessarily be cyber. So we're starting to finally treat cyber as just another problem that's out there and really focusing on, well, who are the actors and how do we deter them in various ways, including and primarily oftentimes physical world and not necessarily just in cyber.
Do you think we understand or the world understands, the major powers understand as enough the potential consequences? So if we tip the scales a little more in terms of offensive versus defensive cyber, do we have enough data now to really understand the all the ramifications and consequences of that? Or are we still working that out?
I think we do. I think in general, we have actually seen fairly limited cyber activity, right? Most of the activity that we see nowadays is espionage activity. You know, we're starting to see these influence operations where the information that is stolen is weaponized and used for information and disinformation operations. But we're not seeing really many kinetic attacks or attacks with kinetic impact. And I think that speaks volumes to the fact that most nation states are not necessarily interested in leveraging cyber in that way, at least today.
So you and I were both out at the RSA Security Conference in San Francisco a couple weeks back. Machine learning, artificial intelligence were terms that were being thrown around a lot out there. You know, CrowdStrike obviously is a company where that's your differentiating technology. So help us understand how to separate the wheat from the chaff when we're talking about machine learning in the context of information security.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Paul. And, you know, the first thing that people need to understand is that the use of machine learning in security specifically is not new. In fact, it's been used for almost 15 years. In fact, my chief scientist, Dr. Sven Kratzer here at CrowdStrike, he and I were using machine learning in our prior lives for spam detection back in the early 2000s and really pioneering some of the early applications of it in the security domain. What's different now is really the advantage that you get of leveraging machine learning alongside cloud crowdsource-based model. So if you look at CrowdStrike, we are essentially collecting every execution event from millions of machines we're protecting to the tune of about 35 billion events every single day. Just to give you a sense of how much data that is, we do in about 5 days what Twitter does in a year in terms of the number of tweets that get posted on that site. So massive amounts of volume, and that really helps you to train the models much more accurately than you could in the past, because the machine learning, you know, those algorithms don't just invent themselves. You have to train them with a lot of training data, and unless you have that rich source of real-world data, your models aren't really going to be as good as they possibly can be. You're going to have a lot of false positives. You're not going to be catching the things that you really want to be catching. So that becomes really, really critical. The other thing is, what do you do machine learning on? And there's a lot of confusion in the industry about this right now. But when you look at the applications of machine learning in the security domain, you can certainly do machine learning on files and sort of statically scan files, extract different features and characteristics from that file and feed into machine learning model. We do that at CrowdStrike. In fact, we have a public engine that is available in VirusTotal. So if someone's submitting malware to VirusTotal, they'll see the CrowdStrike machine learning engine. But you can also apply it in other ways. one of the ways that we're pioneering really applying machine learning is on behaviors themselves. So if a file is not caught for whatever reason before it executes via a machine learning engine, then you actually can look at what is it doing, what are the execution activities that are taking place on the system, and feed that into different machine learning algorithms and train that.
What do you see really as the big drivers within the information security industry right now, both towards greater reliance on machine intelligence or machine learning? Is this primarily about effectiveness? Is it about headcount and trying to realize efficiencies in how companies handle cybersecurity incidents? Where is the pain for your customers?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to appreciate where machine learning is good at and where it's not. Machine learning is very good at finding patterns and finding the proverbial needle in a haystack if the haystack is very, very large, right? So if you're dealing with massive volumes, as you are, you know, frequently on the endpoint or in the spam domain, as I mentioned earlier, it's too many events, too much data for a human to process or for heuristics to really be very effective, or signature-based approaches. So that's where machine learning can come in and take care of the vast volumes in a very, very efficient way. What it's not good at is really finding things that are blending into the sort of overall threat environment and flying under the radar. And that's where you want to use other capabilities. So, you know, the things that I mentioned before where the legitimate tools are in use, and those are very, very rare cases in comparison to kind of overall malicious malware that's, you know, ransomware or other commodity malware that you might see. But those attacks obviously are very sophisticated intrusions that would have a huge impact. So that's where you really want to apply behavioral analytics approaches, crowdsourcing, and threat intelligence to try to identify those types of attacks. And the key thing that has been a trend now for several years, and I'm very happy to see that trend, is a hunting methodology that's being applied. You want to assume that you're compromised. You want to do your hardest to try to find the adversary inside your environment. You want to have everything profiled, particularly the endpoint, and just continuing to hunt 24/7. That's one of the things that we've been very successful at CrowdStrike, is with our OverWatch team hunting 24/7 across all the data we're collecting in our cloud from every machine that we're protecting, and helping to identify about 300 breaches every single month and every single week and stuff.
You know, if you look at the type of legacy environments or, you know, enterprise environments that most security products were designed to secure and protect, and then look at maybe the, your average startup and the type of infrastructure that organization, that company is using and relying on. Those are two very different looking environments. How do you see the industry changing to adapt to the changing ways that technology is used and consumed?
Well, I see security moving in the cloud in part to respond to that threat. So when you look at existing organizations, whether it's startups or whether it's established companies, the old model of everything is on-premise is gone, right? You have mobile workforce, you have people working from home, you have workloads in private clouds and public clouds. So your data and your compute resources are literally everywhere around the world. So your security needs to be everywhere as well. And that speaks volumes to the advantages of having your security live in the cloud and helping to seamlessly protect your data and your machines, regardless of where they are.
That said, we had a pretty serious Amazon outage. Seems like it was human error that caused it, but it was certainly a lot of disruption. And how do we adjust? And you guys are a company that does a lot in the cloud, obviously, as well. So how do you account for that and hedge against that type of a infrastructure outage?
Sure. And, those things can be pretty disruptive. A lot of websites out on the internet were down for a few hours while Amazon had that outage. Amazon needs to look hard at what they're doing. And I know they're taking some lessons from this and building more redundancy into their systems. But generally, when you look at cloud providers, whether it's Amazon or Microsoft or Google, the reliability and the level of service you get there far exceeds what virtually any organization can do themselves, right? And even though, you know, we see a lot of media attention being brought down when you have a incident like the one that just happened, you still have to appreciate that those things are very, very rare, they respond quickly to it and they learn from it and fix it for everyone going forward. And virtually no one in the world can do the level of uptime that those cloud providers are doing and at the scale and volume that they're operating in.
Dan Geer wrote a very famous paper, 10 or 15 years ago about a monoculture, the Windows monoculture. Are we in danger of a cloud monoculture? Is that something that companies should be thoughtful about? I mean, I'm not sure that paper made any difference in terms of people's use of Microsoft, but is it something that companies should be thoughtful about?
Yeah, I think for sure. And, companies that we work with are often using many cloud providers. They're not trying to rely on just one. And luckily in this space, this is not like the desktop where, you have Windows as a predominant operating system. You actually have very healthy competition between all three major cloud providers and a lot of private cloud providers like Rackspace and others that are competing in the space as well. So, you have a very, very healthy competitive environment, and also a lot of tools that organizations can use to easily migrate from one cloud to the other so that they're not stuck with just one vendor.
We lost a really great man this week, Howard Schmidt, former advisor to President Obama and President Bush, chief security officer at eBay and Microsoft, and just a wonderful man. So I wanted to give you a chance to weigh in on that.
Thank you, Paul. And, Howard was a good friend. I've known him for many years, and just the kindest, most humble guy you'd ever meet in this industry in particular, that's so full of people with, big egos. And Howard was just not like that. And he worked quietly and oftentimes in the background and did a lot to move our industry forward, both on the technology side and the policy side, and really was a true pioneer. You look at some of the earliest successes that we've had in this domain going back 25 years, Howard was inevitably part of all of that, whether it was in his law enforcement capacity or as one of the earliest CISOs at some of these big companies that he had worked at, or being the first cyber czar, if you will, during the Obama administration. So very sad day for me personally, and I think for our entire industry, because we lost a true leader and just a great human being.
Yep. Consummate professional as well.
Exactly.
Dmitry, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to the Security Ledger.
Thanks so much, Paul. Always a pleasure.
Dmitry Alperovich is the founder and chief technology officer at the firm CrowdStrike.